You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. This is Write on Radio, the show where we talk to local, national, and international authors about craft, creativity, and the ideas behind their writing. Unfortunately, we do not have our interviewee for today, so we will be playing two interviews from the archives. Let's get right into it.
Rather than patrol another desolate valley, the flight leader climbed into an orbit over the surrounding mountain and ordered the flight to reform. Tom pulled up alongside Jesse's right wing, and together they climbed toward the others. "This is Iroquois Flight 13, the leader radioed the base. Road recon came up dry. Got anything else?" "Copy," the Marine controller replied. "Let me check." Tom and Jesse tucked in behind the leader and his wingman. The trailing two Corsairs slipped in behind them. From the rear of the formation, a pilot named Koenig radioed with alarm. "Jesse, something's wrong. Looks like you're bleeding fuel." Jesse squirmed in a seat to see behind his tail, but his range of vision ended at his seat back. He looked at Tom across the cold space between their planes. Tom glanced leftward and saw a white vapor trail slipping from Jesse's belly. "You've got a streamer, all right," Tom said. Jesse nodded. "Check your fuel transfer," Koenig suggested. "Sometimes fuel overflowed while being transferred from the belly tank to its internal tank." Jesse glanced at the fuel selector switch above his left thigh. The needle in the oil pressure gauge was dropping. Jesse glanced at Tom with a furrowed brow. "I've got an oil leak," he announced. Tom's face sank. The hole in Jesse's tank was a mortal wound. With every passing second, oil was draining, the friction was rising, and the plane's eight cylinders were melting. "Losing power," Jesse said flatly. "Can you make it south?" Tom said. "Nope, my engine's seizing up. I'm going down," Jesse said. Tom frantically scanned the terrain below for a suitable crash site. All he saw were snowy mountains and valleys studded with dead trees. "This can't be happening," Tom thought. "Jesse would never survive a crash in this terrain, and if he did, the sub-zero cold would kill him." Tom glanced down to his kneeboard map and his face twisted. Jesse was going down 17 miles behind enemy lines. If he survived the crash, the enemy would surely double time it to capture him. And if they didn't shoot him on sight, they had an unspeakable torture that they used on captured pilots. Tom glanced over Jesse as their Corsairs plummeted toward the mountains. Jesse's eyes were fixed forward as he tried to sort through a hopeless hand of fate. Tom needed to do something to help his friend, and fast. Jesse's story couldn't end like this.
Very good. You've been listening to Adam Mamakos reading from his new book, Devotion, An Epic Story of Heroism, Friendship, and Sacrifice. He is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, A Higher Call. Adam Mamakos, welcome to Write on Radio.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, this is an amazing story. I mean, a true story of what happened during the Korean War. And you read there from the beginning with Jesse Brown in a plane and Tom Hudner beside him, and Jesse's plane goes down.
Yeah, it's one of the most incredible true stories of any war, of human history. Jesse Brown was shot down that day, December 4th, 1950. They were on a mission over a place called the Chosen Reservoir, and they had never been further from home that day. These were men who came from different worlds who became brothers, and it's just one of the most heartwarming stories.
Yeah, and Tom was sort of a wealthy New Englander, and Jesse was a poor sharecropper's son from, was it Mississippi or Alabama? I can't remember.
He was from Mississippi.
Mississippi.
And Yes, you're exactly right. Jesse was a sharecropper's son, grew up farming the fields barefoot, and when he would see an airplane fly over, he would say, "I'm going to fly someday for the U.S. Navy." Mm. And everyone else would laugh. They would say, they would look at him there, barefoot, a sharecropper, and they would say, "You're never going to make it." But he wanted to serve his country. He wanted to serve a country that viewed him as a second-class citizen.
Right.
And so it was incredible when, in 1949, Jesse earned his wings. He succeeded where everyone else had failed, and he became the first African-American fighter pilot in the U.S. Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just half the story of this book. The other half is Tom Hudner.
Right, right. And we should talk about that, because it's amazing when you think about it. I mean, I tend to forget, because a lot of this stuff happened either before I was born or, I mean, that certainly happened before I was born, but a lot of the civil rights stuff happened before I was born or while I was very young. You know, desegregation was still rampant there. Truman had only integrated the military in, I think, 1948 or something like that. So,
mm-hmm.
People were still saying to black people, "You can't stay at our hotels, you can't eat at our restaurants," and for somebody like Jesse to be able to, you know, get into the Naval Academy and earn his wings is pretty amazing.
It really is. I wonder how many of us today would want to serve a country that treats us that way. And what's even more amazing is his friendship with Tom Hudner. These men were put together in early 1950 in a fighter squadron up in Massachusetts. Now, this is during the Cold War. So the Korean War is looming, but there hasn't been the first shot fired yet.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Hudner was from a different world. Tom came from the country club scene of Massachusetts. So he was born to great privilege. He was expected to go to Harvard and inherit his family's business. And he was going to have a pretty comfy life.
Mm-hmm.
But just like Jesse, he wanted to serve his country. And so he threw away Harvard and everything to go become a Navy fighter pilot.
Yeah.
And so when he and Jesse became friends, you had the opposite ends of the American spectrum. But that's what makes this story so powerful.
Yeah, and Jesse made a lot of friends on the aircraft carrier that he was on. I'm not pronouncing mm-hmm. it correctly, but I mean there was a scene in the book where he celebrates his birthday, and virtually everybody on the ship, it seems like, has put money towards getting him a watch.
Exactly, and I'll have to find a new passage to read, because that was the one that...
Oh, you were going to read that one. Okay. You can read that. That's okay. We can listen to that one later. But well, let's talk a little bit more about Tom, though, because he comes from this New England background. I think he said he had one black person in his school, and so he wouldn't... He said this to the commanding officer prior, so I wouldn't have a problem working with Jesse because we had a black guy in school, and I was a friend of his.
Yeah, that was Tom's exposure. And when they first met, everybody thinks that Tom and Jesse just became best friends and they rode off into the sunset. But really, their first encounter was very awkward. Jesse came in to suit up to fly, and Tom was there in the locker room. And Jesse gave him an awkward wave, and he said, "I guess we're flying together."
Hmm.
And Tom stood up and he said, "Yeah, I'm Tom Hudner." And he put out his hand. And Jesse just stared at it instead of shaking it.
Mm.
Finally, Jesse came around and he shook Tom's hand. And Tom's first thought was, "What an odd guy." Later on, Jesse apologized. He said, "I'm sorry we got off on the wrong foot." You have to understand, during flight training, I would come up to a lot of the instructors and cadets, and I would say, "Hi, I'm Jesse Brown." And I would stick out my hand, and they would keep theirs at their side.
Mm.
He said, "So I don't force myself on people anymore."
Yeah.
And Tom said, "Well, you're never going to have to worry about that with me."
Huh.
And that day, their friendship was born.
Right, right. And a number of other guys, too. You had Koenig, I don't know how it's pronounced, and Marty Good, and, you know, there were a number of these guys in the flight group that they were in, who really became very close. It reminded me in some ways of like Band of Brothers and so forth, where these people are put into this community, this sort of forced crucible, and then their personalities are forged by not necessarily the heat of battle like you get on the ground, but just the high-stress situations that they get put into.
You said it exactly. It's a Navy Band of Brothers. And we were fortunate in telling the story of Tom and Jesse. Not only did we have Tom with us, he's still with us. He's 91 today. So he was sharing his memories. And these other characters you mentioned, they're real-life people, too. And they were contributing to this book. And so we were able to recreate what it was like to be in a fighter squadron and what it was like to go to the Korean War with the help of the men who were there. Mm-hmm. So it's a very vivid nonfiction account, very, I guess you could say clear in the storytelling.
Yeah, very detailed. Yeah. And I was struck by that, too, because I know a few people who were in the Korean War still, friends and relatives, and they just will not talk about it at all. So it seems like that was something that World War II vets and Korean vets just, you know, they were pretty much driven to not talk about that ever. Did you find it difficult to get these people to open up to you or not?
Surprisingly not, Steve. I think airmen represent a different kind of storyline. Mm. I mean, they're above the fray. They're the ones who, in the case of Tom and Jesse's squadron, they were specialists at ground attack. And so their job was to support the Marines from above, to fly into these waves of communist troops and to shoot, to strafe, to drop bombs. And so although what they did was very dangerous and harrowing and traumatizing, at the same time, they were above it all. So they didn't necessarily see the ramifications of their actions like the guys on the ground did. So they were much freer to talk about it.
Okay. And you also bring in Red Parkinson and Ed Kader, who were on the ground as Marines. So it's not like you ignore that part of the battle, because a fairly good-sized chunk of the book deals with their issues on the ground, doesn't it?
It does. And I find that willingness to talk, it totally varies man to man. I think what we saw with this book is these men realize that they are the difference between their buddies being forgotten and remembered. Mm. And so it's one thing if you say, hey, granddad, tell me your war stories. It's another thing when you say, tell me your war stories, because I'm trying to give a face to the Korean War. Mm. You know, this is a forgotten war, and that's not good enough. America should never forget a war.
Right.
We should never forget our veterans. And so you get different levels of storytelling, and these guys will go into that painful past for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I researched it a little bit. I've been researching it. I shouldn't say researching it, studying it a little bit over the years, just because I found it very interesting. And one of the things that I learned was that early on, I mean, that was the brutal part of the war. And later on, the war almost wound down. It continued for a few more years. But during this period that you're writing about, that was when it was actually at its worst. And then it got better. So after 1950, it kind of became a different war for all the participants in many ways.
You're so right. And I don't want to say I'm fortunate, but this story is, it's set in 1950, the first year of the war, really the first 6 months of the war. Mm. And we're able to see the battles from different perspectives. So we see it from the Marines, who are freezing in the snow, fighting in icy creek beds. We see it from Tom and Jesse overhead. And then we also see it from Daisy on the home front, mm-hmm. sending her husband off to war. Now, Daisy is Jesse's wife, of course.
Right.
She sends Jesse off to war, and then we see her deal with the fallout of the Korean War. So we show you the war from the air, land, sea, and home front.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's listen, if we can, to another passage from the book. You can certainly read that one if you want.
Okay. Well, this is one you alluded to earlier. This is during flight training, Jesse encountered something that seems far-fetched, and that is the African-American stewards who served the pilots at their meals. They would see Jesse, that one black face among a sea of white, and they would come up with their food, and they wouldn't give him a chance to actually take it off the plate. You know, they would hold it in front of him for a second or two, and then they would move on to the white cadets because they viewed Jesse as an upstart. So this scene that I'll read now, it's set where Jesse's aboard the carrier in the middle of the Korean War, and the stewards are once again acting funny. And he thought they were his friends because Jesse would always go out of his way to greet them. He was their hero. And now all of a sudden, they're snickering, they're smirking, they're avoiding him at the dinner table. Something is amiss.
Mm-hmm.
Confusion filled Jesse's face. Kenig lowered his cup to the table. "What the heck is going on?" Kenig finally asked. Jesse shook his head. Across the table, Tom Hudner shrugged. He hadn't noticed. A group of stewards drifted from the kitchen and congregated by the back wall, followed by cooks in T-shirts and stained aprons. Their eyes settled on Jesse. The kitchen door swung wide, and a steward emerged carrying a small cake on a tray. Some of the officers' heads turned. When the steward reached Jesse's table, Tom saw an unlit candle on the yellow sponge cake. Jesse's eyes grew wide, and Kenig relaxed in the seat. Tom grinned. Last week was Jesse's birthday, he remembered. The ship's paper had ran a blurb announcing that Jesse had turned 24. "Excuse me, sirs," the steward said to Tom and the man beside him. He leaned in and lowered the cake in front of Jesse, who shook his head in disbelief. "Hey, Jesse," Savoli shouted from down the table. "How did you swing a cake and party with 150 guests? There's a war on, you know." Jesse and the others laughed, but Savoli had a point. The kitchen never celebrated just one man's birthday. The chief steward approached Jesse with a small box in his hands. He was an older black man with a small mustache. His jacket's left sleeve had three red V-shaped patches and a white eagle of a petty officer first class. The other stewards and cooks stepped from the back wall eager to see. "Ensign Brown," the petty officer said, "me and the boys chipped in and got you a little something." He handed Jesse the box. Jesse grinned and surveyed the faces of the kitchen staff. They were smiling, now free to show their excitement. Jesse removed the packaging and flapped open the box top. Nestled inside was a steel watch with a white face and a tiny silver crown for a logo. A Rolex. Jesse's jaw hung open. "Holy cow," Kenig muttered. Along the table, officers leaned in close. The watch had a black leather band and a silver winding crown. "That's a chunk of change," Tom thought. Rolexes were the priciest item in the ship's store. Jesse slid the Rolex over his left wrist and fastened the snap. He held the watch up to catch the light. "Thank you for lifting us up," the petty officer said to Jesse. "Now on this ship, when a black man passes you in the hallway, you never know. He might just be a cook or he might be a flyer." Jesse looked at them all, from the petty officer to the messiest line cook. "Thank you all very much," Jesse said. "I hope I never let you down." "No, thank you," Ensign Brown, the steward replied. The others murmured in agreement. "Enjoy it, sir," said another. "God bless." One by one, the cooks and stewards broke from the gaggle with a nod or a wave and returned to their duties. A steward remained behind. He leaned forward with the lighter and lit the candle on the cake. The flame's tiny light flickered on Jesse's cheeks. In a bashful voice, Kenig broke into song. "Happy birthday to you." Tom and the other officers joined in, and the steward sang too. Jesse grinned as a chorus of warm voices reached a crescendo. As the song ended, applause arose. "Thanks so much, guys," Jesse said. He thanked the steward and waved to the officers up and down the table. "Thank you all." With everyone watching, Jesse leaned forward and blew out the candle.
Very good. That is Adam Makos reading from his new book, Devotion, an epic story of heroism, friendship, and sacrifice. And you're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI. You had a number of sort of amazing moments. I thought back to the Elizabeth Taylor one, too, because she interacted with them a fair amount when they were in the Mediterranean before they were sent off to Korea. And she sort of, in some ways, adopted them, and they sort of adopted her, too.
You're exactly right, Steve. And it was, this book is so much more than a war story. As I always say, it's a war story, but it's a love story. It's an inspirational. And at the end, all I can say is it's an American story.
Mm.
And what more ironic moment than when Tom and Jesse are deployed to the Mediterranean for training. They're just getting to know each other. They're going ashore at Cannes on the Riviera, and these young men are having the time of their lives when they meet Elizabeth Taylor. Except that she's not a celebrity as we picture today. She was a celebrity, but she didn't behave like one.
Mm.
She was so grounded and kind, and in fact, she was lonely because her new husband was already cheating on her, and she was essentially alone on the beach. And as you said, they adopted her, she adopted them, and it's just one of the most incredible moments.
Yeah, Yeah. And you then eventually got to go to North Korea with Tom Hudner as part of your research process and part of his efforts to try to recover various things from the trip.
Yeah, my research took me to all the places where this book is set. So I went from Massachusetts to Mississippi. I went to Cannes, France, to the same beach where these young pilots spent time with Elizabeth Taylor. I went to the same casino where they went gambling with Elizabeth Taylor. Mm. Then in the end, I went to the battlefields of the Korean War, to North Korea. I've been to South Korea to watch, to study the places where these men walked and where they lived and where they fought. Mm. And it's allowed me to tell a story vibrantly. And but it took 7 years of work.
Yeah.
This book was not easily written.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the experience of being in North Korea, because obviously very few of us have been there. Were you there for just a brief time? Did you get a chance to see people like Kim Jong-un? Or was it more just you were in the background and you were observing the various dignitaries conversing back and forth?
Well, it was a little bit of both. Mm. We were there, of course, and I almost don't want to spoil it, but we were there to keep a promise from the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
Tom made a promise that he would go back.
Yeah.
And it all was explained in devotion, of course. And so at age 89, he traveled across the ocean, and I got to, of course, go with him to keep that promise. And so we heard from Kim Jong-un, the dictator, who actually admired that Tom came that far to keep a promise to a friend. And we were treated very well by the North Korean army. They took us to, we watched a fireworks show with Kim Jong-un sitting 50 feet away.
Wow.
And so we weren't like Dennis Rodman. You know, Dennis Rodman was there to glad hand.
Right.
We were there on a mission to honor an American serviceman. And so it was very different circumstances. North Korea was, my mom was very worried. She was saying, why are you doing this? Tom's family was a little worried. What is he getting himself into? But in the end, the fact that Tom is a Medal of Honor recipient, he received the Medal of Honor during the Korean War, our highest award for valor, it kept us safe because the North Koreans respected that.
Right. And you, one of the other characters in the book, Lieutenant Ream, is it Bob Ream, also won a Medal of Honor, as I recall.
Yeah, there are two Medal of Honors in this book. And Bob Ream, I can spoil a little bit of it. He sacrificed his life for a friend.
Hmm.
And so there's a common theme in the book, devotion.
Yeah.
It's a question. Why will one man give up his life for another?
Yeah.
What leads a man to do that?
Yeah.
And what leads a man to go off to war to certain death for his country? And it's a question I have to ask myself. What would I have done?
Yeah, and Ed Coderre asks that question after that experience as well. And you cover somewhat similar ground in A Higher Call, too. I mean, that's World War II, and that's a German pilot who has the opportunity to shoot down, is it a British or an American pilot?
American bomber, yeah.
Yeah, and chooses not to and guides him back to across the North Sea. So there's kind of a commonality, a thread there. Is that how you found this story while you were researching and writing that story, or how did you come across this to begin with?
You're exactly right. For me, A Higher Call, I thought that was the greatest story I'd ever come across. German fighter ace spares an American bomber, escorts him out of Germany, and later on the men become best friends. It seems like a tall tale, but it really happened.
Mm.
So that was A Higher Call. Now, with devotion, the big moment that drew me to this story was what happened on the day when Jesse Brown was shot down behind enemy lines, because he crash-landed on the side of a North Korean mountain. He was trapped in his aircraft. The airplane was starting to catch on fire. And overhead, Tom looked down, and he saw his friend in danger, and he said, I'm going in.
Mm.
And he did something that had never been attempted before. It has never been repeated since. He crash lands his perfectly good aircraft on the side of the mountain in the snow, and he comes to a stop right alongside of Jesse's plane. And Tom gets out, and he wades through the snow on a one-man rescue mission to try to save his friend.
Mm.
And it's a true story.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely spellbinding real-life story.
Yeah. It really is. I enjoyed it immensely. I thought you did a great job with it. We're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it at that. But this is Steve McElstrom speaking with Adam Makos about his new book, Devotion, An Epic Story of Heroism, Friendship, and Sacrifice. Adam Makos, thanks for being on Right on Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve. I enjoyed it.
Great. And now this.
KFAI is proud to present Extreme Noise 30th Anniversary at the Cedar Cultural Center, Saturday, November 16th.
Headlining are the snarling and irreverent pioneers of Midwestern punk, the Zero Boys.
Who are still living in the 80s. Why not?
The mayhem continues with Portland's Long Knife, the solo slashings of the globe-trotting Sick Thoughts, along with the melodic malfeasance of Color TV and the nonlinear sonic salaciousness of the Citric Dummies.
All while being DJed by the one and only Patrick Costello.
Tickets can be found at the Cedar Cultural website. Visit thecedar.org for more details.
Everybody's doing the slam and the worm!
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Zimmerman, and this is your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. On Wednesday, November 13th, 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Minneapolis Central Library, the book launch of Art and Artifact, Murals from the Minneapolis Uprising. The catalog accompanying an exhibition of murals created in Minneapolis and St. Paul after the murder of George Floyd, featuring speakers Howard Oransky, Amira McClendon, Lisa Kelly, and Setu Jones. On Wednesday, November 13th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers in Minneapolis, Poetry Night with Tim Nolan and Philip Bryant. On Thursday, November 14th, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at the Edina Senior Center, Glenn Miller will present Doorman Wanted. On Thursday, November 14th, 5 to 7 p.m. at Elmer L. Anderson Library in Minneapolis, reception and guided gallery tours of the exhibit Journey to Joy, Rise, Relevance, Representation in Children's Picture Books. On Thursday, November 14th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Milkweed Books in Minneapolis, Kinsale Drake will launch The Sky Was Once a Dark Blanket in conversation with Hyde E. Erdrich. On Thursday, November 14th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Eat My Words Bookstore in Minneapolis, Karen Engstrom will present The Fox. On Thursday, November 14th, 7 to 8 p.m. in Plymouth Congregational Church in Minneapolis, Elizabeth Jarrett Andrew will launch The Release, Creativity and Freedom After the Writing is Done. Liz did an interview with Elizabeth Jarrett Andrew just a few weeks ago. Saturday, November 16th, 10:30 to 11:15 a.m. at Wild Rumpus Books in Minneapolis, John Coy and Chris Park will present So Cold. on Saturday, November 16th, 10:30 to 11 a.m. at Red Balloon Bookshop in St. Paul, Donald Lemke and Bob Lentz celebrate their new book, Author vs. Illustrator, with a fun story time with themed activities and hilarity. Come see what happens when an illustrator decides to draw a story different than the one the author is telling. On Saturday, November 16th, from 12 to 2 p.m., at Once Upon a Crime in Minneapolis, Mark Hoffman, Bonnie Older, Jolene Stratton Philo, and James Tucker will sign their books. On Saturday, November 16th, 2 to 3 p.m., at Big Hill Books in Minneapolis, David La Rochelle and Mike Wunutka will present Mr. Fox's Game of No. On Saturday, November 16th, 3 to 4 p.m. at The Thinking Spot in Wayzata, Jeff Olson will present Kindred Spirits. On Saturday, November 16th, 6:15 to 9 p.m. at The Hive Collaborative in St. Paul, join writers Cao Kalia Yang and midwife Jessica Holm to watch and talk about the movie Parallel Mothers. On Sunday, November 17th, 2 to 3 p.m. at Big Hill Books in Minneapolis, Maybelle Ikwe will present The Little Frog's Guide to Self-Care. On Sunday, November 17th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Red Balloon Bookshop in St. Paul, Book Talk sensation Alex Astor celebrates the third novel in the best-selling Lightlark saga, Skyshade. On Monday, November 18th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Red Balloon Bookshop in St. Paul, the Red Balloon Bookshop's Teens Read Book Club, open to teens in the 8th to 12th grade, occurs on the third Monday of every month. On Monday, November 18th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Red Balloon Bookshop in St. Paul, join middle grade authors Jessica Vitalis, Rena Heisel, and Payal Doshi as they discuss the animals in their books and middle grade literature. On Monday, November 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Lucky's 13 Pub in Mendota, monthly live Meet the Author event featuring Michael Farisee and Alan Miller. On Monday, November 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. at 412 Pillsbury Hall in Minneapolis, Gia Tolentino will discuss her New York Times best-selling essay collection, Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. On Monday, November 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers in Minneapolis, Poetry Night with V. Joshua Adams and Chelsea DeSaltis. On Tuesday, November 19th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Big Hill Books in Minneapolis, Jessica Vitalis will present Unsinkable Cayenne in conversation with Jacqueline West. On Tuesday, November 19th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Subtext Books in St. Paul, Dennis Smith will present Blues in Stereo. On Tuesday, November 19th, 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the University Club of St. Paul, friends of Tim Nolan will be reading from Tim's new book of poems, Things I Didn't Know I Love, published by Noden Press. Poet Ted King will be hosting the event, and among the readers will be Joyce Sutphin, Cao Kalia Yang, Bubba Henson, Denny Klecko, and others. Then Tim will read some of the poems that none of his friends want to read. There will be cake and refreshments after we're all done reading. This has been your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. There are many other events you can check out at the Rain Taxi site at raintaxi.com. And now, this.
I'm here speaking with Zach Wiener-Smith for his new book, Soonish, 10 Emerging Technologies That'll Improve and or Ruin Everything. Zach Wiener-Smith is the cartoonist behind the popular geek webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. His work has been featured in The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, Slate, Forbes, Science Friday, Boing Boing, The Freakonomics Blog, Discovery Magazine, and many more. And also, I found out reading Soonish that he drew a lot of wiener jokes in his 20s, so my kind of guy. Thanks for being on. thank you for being right on radio
Pleasure.
With us.
Good introduction for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about your introduction to Soonish. You firstly showed me what chess boxing was, so thank you for that. But you talk about how technology. Yeah. I had a lot of fun actually going to YouTube watching different videos. Technology is, it's not just a matter of accumulating better and better things, but it often results from discoveries within different fields. But despite this, it's not always clear if technology is going to have actual spot in the marketplace. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little, Zach.
Yeah, so there's a pretty good business these days in trying to predict the future. Unfortunately, it seems to us that all the good predictions one can make are obvious. You know, so you can make predictions about how fast computers will be, how cheap batteries will be, how efficient solar panels will be. It's fairly easy to do because you're talking about the evolution of pre-existing, well-developed technologies. But when it comes to predicting what the actual future overall will be like, that's tough because a lot of this stuff is contingent. Mm-hmm. The example we use in the book is there's actually a through line from, you know, an early discovery by Faraday with glassware to mind reading technologies that goes through, you know, the liquefaction of gases, which leads to refrigeration, which leads to being able to supercool metals, which leads to superconductors, which leads to powerful magnetic fields, which leads to brain scanning devices. But there was no way that Faraday could have said, this liquid gas gives me an idea. I wonder if we could scan brains someday with this.
Yeah.
The path is quite meandering, and actually that's typical. So trying to predict the future of that sort of thing is a dicey business, and I don't think anyone's ever done a very good job of it. So basically we don't try.
Yeah. Talked about future predictions. I know you you bring up the study from 2011 called Are Talking Heads Blowing Air, that it showed most prominent public figures are actually god-awful at trying to predict making predictors of the future, but also actually kept all their jobs. Was it this study that kind of started kind of acting as a catalyst where you got to thinking about making this book Soonish?
I would say it was that sort of thing. There's actually a much deeper study done by Philip Tetlock, sort of famously described in a book called Super Forecasting, where there's like a reverse association between prominence and ability to predict the future events. We were interested in this because often when you read about future technology in blogs or books, et cetera, they're overly optimistic. They predict, you know, in the near term we'll be flying to Mars and we'll, you know, be, I don't know, teleporting or whatever it is. And it turns out if you talk to a competent working scientist in a lot of these fields, they could actually tell you why some of this stuff is not going to happen. And often you see stuff breathlessly reported in the media that is just not, doesn't even pass the sniff test in terms of its physics. But a lot of this stuff you wouldn't know if you hadn't done a little homework that most people don't do. So our thought was, well, let us do the homework and we can try to give you, you know, the optimistic take, but with all the necessary skepticism about some of these technologies.
Yeah. On that note, at the end of the book, I thought was really interesting. You have basically a whole chapter dedicated to what you call the graveyard chapters, which were different pieces you were considering putting into the book, but you had to actually leave on the cutting board. How did you decide what topics you were going to leave into the book? I know the one with quantum computing I thought was really fascinating, but like you said, for one, it's kind of hard. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to find people who actually are very competent in knowing to talk about that, and actually it gets into a very weird, different realm. So,
yeah. So for us, it was kind of like it was almost like we wanted to be honest with our audience. So we actually originally started with something like 50 technologies. And we eventually cut it down to just 10. And part of what happened there is we would dig into something, and it would just seem to us like it really wasn't there. It wasn't plausible. So to give an example, and I hope this isn't too disappointing for your listeners, but there's been this idea that's been proposed at least since the 70s, maybe earlier, to do space-based solar power of some sort. That is to say, put either photovoltaic panels in space or in an earlier formulation to have a sort of giant mirror that focuses heat and to generate energy in space and then beam it down to Earth using a microwave beam. And you do that because the atmosphere is fairly transparent in the microwave band. The problem is just when you crunch the numbers, it just doesn't look very good. Even if the technology for getting stuff to space gets a lot better and a lot cheaper, it's almost always a better idea to put more solar panels in like the Sahara or Arizona or Australia than to send them up into space. So the most optimistic case is that a space-based solar panel might be about 40 times better because you're in constant sunlight, there's no weather, et cetera. But the prices always, we think, we did some analysis, and a person we talked to at NASA agreed with this. It's almost all certain that it will always be 40 times cheaper or better to just put up one more solar panel down here on Earth. So sadly, we felt we just couldn't do a chapter trying to talk about the future of space-based solar as a power source for Earth. It just doesn't seem plausible.
Yeah. I think the great thing I had, or the great fun I had reading this book, is that you say in the beginning how there's this immense difficulty in trying to do something like mining an asteroid or bioprinting. It gives you understand the reader a couple things. One, that all the innovations we've already had in the past, it took serious effort that we should probably appreciate now. And the audience can be more excited when other new marvels become a reality. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, part of our outlook was that the challenges themselves are really interesting. I mean, never mind the thing you'll get when it's figured out. You know, the fact that it's really hard and difficult to make a tether that goes from Earth to outer space is objectively interesting, I think. The fact that part of the problem with 3D printing a liver is that the liver has this complicated vascular system, so you have to come up with some way to generate veins using 3D printing methods. Like, that's interesting whether it works or not. So we really wanted to get into that sort of stuff, the problems of technique and basic science that the researchers are doing right now.
Okay, I want to ask you now if you can explain for our audience. So that was one of my favorite methods, I think, reading about in space travel. So there's this option of having like a 62,000-mile-long ribbon-like cable attached to a space station in geostationary orbit with a counterweight of an asteroid that's actually outside of space. Why hasn't this happened, Zach?
the main reason, there are many reasons, but the main reason we is what we call the middle part, that part you described, the cable, the 62,000-mile-long cable. So the deal is, very quickly, the reason you would want this is because rockets are rockets are what we use for all space launch now. But if you look at a rocket, you're mostly looking at propellant. It's about 80% propellant. So basically, you burn up a rocket and propellant to get a tiny amount of stuff into space. We say it's like if you wanted to fly on a plane to Hawaii, but at the end you exploded the plane and just jumped out, the ticket would be very expensive. And that's what we do in space. So one idea is if you have a space elevator, which is, as you described, this cable that goes up to space, you just get in a sort of capsule that rides up the tether, and then you beam the fuel as you go. So there's no point at which you're just carrying more fuel you're going to use later. And so in theory, this gets the price down 99% or something like that. The problem is, as you say, the middle part. You need a material that is extraordinary. It needs to be incredibly strong, and it needs to be incredibly lightweight. And there are only a couple of candidate materials, like carbon nanotubes is one of them. And we need it to be a 62,000-mile-long molecule of carbon nanotube, and we're up to about a foot and a half is the best we've ever done. There's a little room for improvement.
So the difficulty with space travel is launching rockets is super expensive, and the space on board is mostly taken by propellant. One of the solutions also in the chapter I really liked was this possibility of laser ignition. Can you talk about that a little?
Without belaboring the physics, fundamentally, the speed with which your rocket goes relates to how hot and fast you're throwing stuff out the back of it, right? So this is very intuitive if you think about it. If you have a balloon and you let it go, it zips around the room, and it works on the exact same principle as a rocket. So you can imagine if the gas inside the balloon is a lot hotter, it's going to go a lot faster. The theory is, well, suppose you have a rocket. Rocket's already burning really hot, but you could shoot laser energy into the back of the rocket and heat it up a lot, and then you're basically giving the rocket more energy. Now, you might say, why not put this laser system just on the rocket? The deal is that it weighs a lot, so it wouldn't be worth it. But if on the ground you had a system that could just discharge an enormous amount of energy for about a minute as the rocket is picking up speed, that can make a big difference. And the other thing to note is, when you look at a rocket, only about 3% of it actually goes to space. The rest is the rocket and the fuel. So if you improve the efficiency just a tiny bit, you can actually double the amount of cargo, right? You just have to get from 3% to 6%. So if you just make it a little better, it makes a big difference in price. So the military has tried to build giant high-energy lasers that aren't even close to what you would need to pull this off. And suffice it to say, it's a ways out. It would take an enormous amount of energy, and it would be extremely hot. And also, maybe astronauts would be a little uncomfortable having giant lasers fired at them as they shoot to space.
No doubt. I want to ask you now about asteroid mining. If you want to be pioneers in space, why is asteroid mining so crucial for that?
Right. So, as we said, the hard part about going to space isn't the technology, although that's there. The hard part is that it's really expensive. The reason that it's expensive is because while you're on Earth, you're in what's called a gravity well. So you can imagine if you want to get something to the top of a building, it's a lot harder than to just bring it to the bottom of the building, right? So if you wanted to build, like, you know, a car on top of a building, the best way to do it would be to have the car parts already up there, and then you just ascend and get them. So that's the idea with asteroids, right? So if you want to put a giant Star Trek-y spaceship in space, you need a lot of, like, metals, you need air, you need other stuff. You can boost that from Earth, but it's extraordinarily expensive. So the idea with asteroid mining, the best idea, there are a lot of variations, but the idea that we thought was interesting is really all you need to do is boost a factory into space that can refine materials, and then you can go out to the asteroid belt or to near-Earth objects and refine their materials. So you can get a much bigger spaceship for the same price. So really, we argue that if you ever want to see a giant sort of Star Trek-style spaceship, probably it's going to have to be built in the asteroids where there's so much material available for cheap.
Yeah. Nuclear fusion, as you talk about in the book, is probably the ultimate solution for our human energy needs. It's clean. It can be used in common elements as fuel, and it carries no risk of catastrophic meltdown. But there are some serious hurdles in trying to harness this energy. How come?
Well, so we know fusion can work because it works inside the sun. The problem is the sun has something we don't, which is extremely concentrated gravity, this extremely concentrated pressure at its core. And so we cannot duplicate that on the Earth. There's no way to sort of make gravity suddenly appear like that in vast quantities. So the alternative approaches all are about delivering a whole lot of energy to a small area in a way that's symmetric so it doesn't just blow itself apart too quickly. And it just turns out that's an extremely difficult problem. And unfortunately, for the conventional methods we have, the way around that problem is you just build larger and larger and larger systems. There are a couple of heterodox approaches. There's a company, this has happened since we wrote the book, called Commonwealth Fusion, spun out from MIT, that's working on some superconducting technology that will maybe allow it to be done in a more compact way. But fundamentally, so far, it still has to be really, really, really big, which means it's really, really expensive, takes a long time to set up, and even if you could make it work, it might not pay. But of course, as you say, if you did, the fuel it uses is plentiful, and it produces almost no nasty byproducts. It really would, if it could be done cheaply, it should be able to replace all other energy sources and have us live in a world where everything is cheaper and easier to come by.
The biggest, most expensive fusion project you mentioned is this thing called ITER, I think, the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. The experiment is set to happen, I think, in a chamber called the tokamak, with a tokamak configuration. I was wondering if you could describe how that works a little bit.
Sure. So as I was saying, there are two major tricks with getting your fusion fuel to fuse. And they're, one, you have to deliver a lot of energy to a small area, but two, it has to be delivered symmetrically. So we describe it as, like, you want to really compress some air inside a balloon. You know, if you deliver a lot of energy to it on one side, it'll just bow out on the other side. And it's vaguely similar for plasma, which is the fuel for fusion. So a tokamak, if you want to visualize, it's like a giant metal donut.
Yeah.
It has magnetic fields running around it that are set up so it can do what's called a Z-pinch, which just means it has enormous unleashing of energy into this so that the plasma condenses, or not condenses, gets focused to a tiny region in the middle of the donut, like a ring. And also at ITER, they're doing some other stuff to heat it by using, like, a neutral beam of particles, all sorts of stuff, methods to try to get it to light up, to fuse in a self-sustaining manner. Anyway, without getting too into it, I worry I'll go off the rails, but, like, essentially, like, it's kind of like a candle. If you can get enough energy that it starts this plasma fusing, then the energy that unleashes will light more of the plasma. Mm-hmm. And then you can get a self-sustaining cycle where you can get just infinite energy just by burning up hydrogen, which is, of course, the most common element in the universe. The problem is, you know, you described ITER, I-T-E-R, the big tokamak setup in Europe. It's going to, by the time it's done, it's going to cost something like $20 to $30 billion. So to put that in perspective, you know, a new nuclear plant using conventional fission technology is probably somewhere more in the world of $2 to $5 billion. So ITER's not designed to make money; it's just designed to show that it can be done. And then sometime in the future, this plant called Demo that's supposed to be built that kind of follows up to try to make a demonstration plant. But it's all pretty far off these days and quite expensive.
Yeah. So an interesting chapter I really liked in Sumish was one you focused on for programmable matter, and it's most ambitious, based like a T-1000 in Terminator 2, right? It's just this thing that you can kind of stick your hand into anything and turn and shape matter into anything you want. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the origami robots that have been developed at MIT.
Yeah. So the sort of fundamental idea with programmable matter is you have a single object that can turn into lots of different types of objects, something like how, you know, a single computer can run all sorts of programs. And so if you think about it, origami is this thing where you take a single piece of paper, say, and it can turn into, you know, millions of different configurations just by the right sequence of folds. So in principle, it's not literally universal, but it can do all sorts of different stuff. So why would you want this? Well, one, it'd be awesome. You could make little toys that sort of fold themselves up and walk around the room. But there's also Daniela Roos's lab at MIT had this idea for a robot that's made of the paper would be like sausage casing, and you put it in ice and then you swallow it like a pill, and then it can do medical work. Their specific proposal was that I guess something like 3,000 Americans a year present with a watch battery stuck in their gut, and it's hard to extract. It's not a fun surgery. So if you could have this little robot that kind of swims down, latches onto the battery, and then swims it away, and then, you know, dissolves on the way out, that would be pretty cool. There are a number of other potential uses for it, but it's still pretty rudimentary, and the folding system is quite slow. But maybe one day.
In the book, you mentioned you were really excited by these hard hats that would come equipped with augmented reality from this group, Daiquiri. Can you talk about how this will make probably workers more efficient in the future?
Yeah, so people might know a version of augmented reality from playing Pokemon Go. You know, the basic idea is you have a virtual world overlaid on your real world. So mostly I think people think about entertainment for that, but there are all sorts of really practical applications. So one idea is work training, right? So imagine you're learning how to assemble an engine or something. Of course, it helps to have an expert right next to you, but it would really help if that expert could control your field of view, tell you what you were looking at, tell you what the next part is. There have actually been studies done that show that people learn much more quickly by this method. To me, that's pretty intuitive. I think that would be that would really help you move quickly in learning how to do something with your hands. There's also, you can imagine, augmented reality surgery, right? So where a heads-up display for a surgeon tells you exactly where to cut, where to go. There's another application that we thought was really cool for civil engineering, which is, you know, you can imagine you have this helmet on and you look down and it's like you have X-ray vision. You can see the pipes below the ground. So that's the kind of stuff you could do with augmented reality that at least that was kind of more exciting than the entertainment value, although that is something that's coming too.
Yeah. There's a burgeoning field that you dedicate some time to the book about with brain-computer interfaces. It's a strange blend of this incredibly complex science. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about this section of the book where you describe possible upgrades we could do with deep brain stimulation.
Yeah. So deep brain stimulation is like a much more advanced version of electric shock therapy. So essentially, there are people who have conditions like severe depression, or they have regular epileptic fits, and these conditions don't respond well to the conventional treatments. One thing you can do is have a sort of electrode embedded in the brain that sends out electric signals based on what the brain is doing, or even just at regular intervals. And it is apparently showed potential benefits for a number of medical conditions for reasons that are not well understood. There are also, you know, so that's something we can already do. In the future, you can imagine being able to tell stuff about your own brain, like, you know, tell about people's moods. We can tell stuff like, are you lapsing in focus? You can imagine for prosthetic devices, there's already some stuff like this coming along. You can tell if someone is using the part of their brain that corresponds to a specific body part. For people who have what's called locked-in syndrome, where they can't move any part of their body, but their brain still works, There are applications where you can move a cursor around using brain scanning devices. So there's lots of cool stuff. Potential privacy concerns, of course, but the medical applications are kind of amazing.
Yeah. Okay, my last two questions for you, Zach. I was wondering if you could talk about probably the most fascinating element of your research or this book, or the technology that you're probably most excited for the future.
Oh, the space stuff. we're super into going to space on the cheap. Yeah, I'm a coward. I don't think I would actually go, but it'd be nice to know other people could.
Yeah. Okay. I was reading a little bit. You have another book coming out in October. Is that right? It's called "Open Borders: The Science and Ethics of Immigration."
Yes, it's mildly controversial.
How is that working out? I think you did it with Brian Kaplan, who's an economist, right? I was kind of wondering how that worked for you, because that was that your first work doing a book with collaborating with someone outside with your not your wife?
Yeah. I guess, well, I mean, I've done like minor collaborations, but this is, yeah, as you say, the first sort of big full-on collaboration I've done with my wife. It's cool. I like to study different things. I'm interested in economics and immigration, and he has, to say the least, fairly heterodox views on what immigration policy should be. And we just thought, you know, it's a really interesting perspective, and I wanted to help get it out there.
Great. You were just listening to me talk with Zach Wienerspith about his new work, Soonish, 10 Emerging Technologies That Improve and or Ruin Everything. Please check it out. It's a lot of fun to go through. Zach, thanks for being on Right on Radio with me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And now this.
Remember that batteries, paint, weed killer, chemicals don't belong in the trash. Bring items like these to Ramsey County's Household Hazardous Waste Collection sites. It's free. For more information, visit ramseyrecycles.com/HHW or call 651-633-3279. That's 651-633-3279.
Have been listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Zimmerman. We would like to thank our past guests, KFAI listeners and supporters, and our Right on Radio listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. If you've missed any shows or want to listen to this one again, you can check out all your favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you stream your podcasts. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.